Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today I have a very special guest on, somebody who I'm looking forward to speaking to. Her name is Ms. Rosemary Frey, and she has a master's in science and molecular biology from the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Calgary. She was a freelance medical writer and journalist for 22 years, and now she's an independent investigative journalist. She has many interviews, and you can see one of her most recent ones on June 15th called The Corbett Report. And she's written articles and off-Guardian articles, and she also has a Twitter account, and that would be Rosemary Frey, F-R-E-I-T-O. And today we're going to talk about a topic that I think we're all living in, but we may not really, some of us have turned off, some of us have tuned out, some of us have gotten so frustrated they just stopped following it. But I think it's really important in the age of COVID to figure out where we're going, because this is, the longer this is going, the more I'm questioning exactly what happened and how it's going forward. And here in the States, we're starting shutdowns again in some cities and some states. And I think we really need to understand statistics, because it just seems like it's all over the place. So Ms. Frey has a couple of articles, one which is really timely, about what's going on in the long-term care facilities. And I know as a former New Yorker, we've seen a lot of deaths and a lot of, I think 50% of the deaths almost in the United States have been from people, seniors and people in long-term care facilities. And your article is very timely because I think you ask a question I think is on the back of many of our minds. So I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much, Elaine. It's my pleasure. I'm glad you asked me on.
So let's talk a little bit about your background. How did you leave medical writing and become an investigative journalist? It's really an interesting story.
I just got tired, basically, of being lied to every time I picked up the phone to interview a medical scientist or a medical researcher. Every time they tell me their research was unbiased, but every time I detect a strong bias, in fact, basically based on the funding of that research. So they'd always be lying to me, and I had to figure out what they were lying to me about, and I just got really tired of it. And each article, of course, I'd try to point out where they were lying, but after a while, it's just too much. I had enough. But then I got dragged back into writing about medicine. I'd intended not to write about it again, and I didn't write about medicine for two or three years. And then because of looking at the vaccine issue, I got dragged back in, and then COVID hit us all hard, and in terms of, headlines, et cetera, and so I'm dragged back into it heavily.
Well, I'm glad you're dragged back in, because I think you're a voice of reason. Your articles are not inflammatory, they're informational. And one of the things, at least in the States, if you turn on the TV or listen to the radio, it is just, a fear fest. And I don't think, and I think most people who've reached the limit of being, trying to be made afraid, have just given up. But we really do need to understand this. So if we're listening to statistics and they change. I mean, let's talk about how COVID was first put out. We were talking about the death rate, and it was the number one thing that any news media spoke about. Now they don't talk about the death rate anymore in this supposed second wave. It's only the number of cases. And from what you're saying, it sounds like if you talk to whomever you talk to, depending on their point of view and their political persuasion, you're going to get a different answer. We're seeing that with our CDC. What's going on in Canada? Is it the same?
Are you talking about in terms of the switch of the narrative from the death rate, to the number of cases?
Correct.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, and they're just saying, well, we have to keep all these measures in place or heighten them because we still have cases. They just sort of left logic, and they're just now firmly in control of whatever narrative they want. Well, there's some cases that we have to, so people can't go to their churches. Or, there's been one death out of 2 million people, so it's clearly we have to keep people sequestered or or separated and have to have their masks on and be washing their hands. It just is not the evidence base. It seems to be at all important to them, if it ever was.
No, I would have to agree with that. For us, it's wear the mask, don't wear the mask, and now wear a mask in your home by yourself. I mean, it's not science-based at all. It's just, it's almost like they're grasping at straws, because people, I understand at the beginning, nobody really knew what this was going to be, and it was the fear of the unknown. But as it's unfolded over the past 3 to 4 months, we've reached our peak, and the concept of herd immunity doesn't seem to exist for people. But just because you test positive doesn't mean you're ill. And I see that they're not testing antibodies, which would be kind of interesting to test, because that would tell you that the person has been infected and they've recovered from it. That's a whole different ballgame than someone in an ICU, the way it was at the beginning, isn't it?
Well, I'd like to unpack a bit of what you said. First of all, you said the concept of herd immunity doesn't seem to exist for people. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you have a disease that's going through the community, you want people to be exposed so that they can actually get it and recover from it, which means it's not going to sweep the community and kill people. Because usually the natural process of an infection is that if you survive it, you're immune to it. And as it goes through people, it gets less virulent. So it's less lethal as it goes through the community. I think they did it in Sweden. They never shut down. They didn't do it really in Japan. They didn't shut down. And they didn't see as many deaths. So you can't you can't stay in your house. There's no way you can avoid this thing. And the people who are young, which we see now, are getting it. And they have very mild symptoms. But once it goes through the community, you can move on, basically.
You're saying there is herd immunity, basically. We have reached that. Enough people have been exposed to it.
I think that we have, but we're not. That's not what the media is saying. They're saying there's more cases, so it's another spike, and we need to go back in our rabbit hole. That's not what they should be saying. They should be happy that we're testing so many millions, and only a small percentage are actually going to the hospital, and most didn't even know they had it. That's a different mentality, and that lets people come back into the land of living, as opposed to living, you know, minute to minute that something's going to happen to them. It's just a psychological, people being put upon psychologically, and it's messing with not only our economy, but the mental health of individuals. And in your article, I'd say the seniors had taken a huge brunt of this, of the procedure of diagnosing, treating, and how it's rolled out, at least in the United States, and probably in Canada. But what have you seen in terms of, here we had orders to send the seniors back from hospitals to their long-term care facilities, their senior citizens' homes, instead of them being healthy. Did that happen in Canada as well?
Well, I didn't mention that maybe just as an aside, but I think the main factors I talked about were the fact that they had extremely broad definitions of a novel coronavirus infection and of a novel coronavirus outbreak. I think the same applied in the States. So you could have, at first, at least in March, you could have a person in a long-term care home with sniffles, and oh, you've got COVID, and oh, that means, you know, if one person has any symptoms, they're deemed to have COVID, and then the whole facility is deemed to be in an outbreak. And then anybody else who had any symptoms, they could have pink eye, or they could have stomach pain, and oh, you've got COVID. And then, of course, if any of those people in that facility die, they're deemed to have died of COVID, even if they weren't tested. So that was one of the conditions. And also, there was triaging guidelines that were put together in the States and in Canada and elsewhere, saying that the old people should be last in line for care. And also, the guidelines, at least in Canada, said that care home residents should not be transferred to hospitals, even if they needed hospital care. And thirdly, the coroner in Ontario changed the rules such that bodies are whisked away out of long-term care homes and hospitals as quickly as possible, and so there's no opportunity whatsoever for, if there was something that maybe was deemed suspicious, there's no opportunity to actually go to the body in situ at the place where that person died. And also the death certificates are no longer completed by somebody who actually had anything to do with the person before they died, never mind viewing the body or anything after death. And this is completely contrary to any sort of good medical practices and for proper medical certification of death. So put this all together, and you just need, you know, it's an open door for people who are following the rules directly and fully and saying, okay, this person's got diarrhea, and so they must have COVID. We have to put them in palliative care because there's nothing else that can be done for them. We can transfer them to the hospital. And then if they die, they're deemed to have died of COVID. And there's no recourse in terms of any investigation of what the person actually died of. And this is just months after, in Canada, we had an Ontario medic take inquiry called the Wetlaufer inquiry, where a nurse confessed to killing quite a few people in long-term care homes. And so the Wetlaufer inquiry recommendations were for a lot more transparency around circumstances of death and death certification. And that's not all been wiped away and pushed back to the back burner and beyond. This is like complete lack of transparency. And this is, and the person, the chief coroner for Ontario, who put those new rules in place, which equate to great lack of transparency, is now in charge of all testing for the novel coronavirus in the whole province. So for his good deed of making less transparency, he has been greatly promoted by the powers that be. Very interesting. So I would not be surprised at all if similar circumstances, as well as that fear campaign you were talking about, fear trumping evidence or any real concrete information, I wouldn't be surprised if that's very much in play across the United States as well.
Well, I want people to think about that and digest what you just said. And let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in the Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Rosemary Fry. And before the break, you were really breaking down I have no words, really. The people who seem to make these mistakes get rewarded, and they seem to always have power over everybody else. I mean, all of these things, from a medical standpoint that you just described, don't make sense. How do you count people who you're not absolutely sure have the diagnosis of the disease? And I remember, I mean, at least one for us, when WHO made their new codes for COVID, they actually have a code that you can put in as a physician that says you're diagnosing them with COVID, but you don't have any kind of lab evidence. That's not a diagnosis, in my opinion. It just allows you to count people, you know, willy-nilly, if you want to say it. But it counts in terms of what they're making us do from a social perspective. Now with our second wave, we're seeing somewhat what you just described. There, you know, the people who are doing the counting of any kind of cohort, like if you've been around somebody, and there's people now who look to see if anybody else has been infected. I forget what it's called, I'm drawing a blank, but basically, if you're infected, anybody you've come in contact with now gets to be counted as having COVID, whether they've been tested or not. That's another erroneous number that's come up. So, I mean, I see a bigger picture here. If you have an unlimited number of people and you never have an endpoint, what happens socially from your investigations? Is there another process at foot here? Is COVID and pandemic being used to bring in more control from a top-down perspective?
Absolutely. If you look at the, I think it's $50 billion that the U.S. government fairly recently allocated for contact tracing and follow-up. And that's a mass system of surveillance. And it's interesting to follow the contacts of who is you know, follow the money as usual, and that's a lot of money to be made, and it's not at all clear why this should be happening at all. If this disease exists, and there's certainly controversy about whether it exists at all, whether the novel coronavirus exists at all, I've written about that, you can't eradicate it, so why are they putting this persistent effort that's unprecedented? We haven't done this with any other infectious disease, even with ones that have maybe similar death rates. So this is clearly about, and I talk about that in my 7 steps from pandemic to totalitarianism. There was an off-guardian earlier this year. I talk about how this is very much part of the agenda of just a surveillance state, all pervasive, 24/7 surveillance, totalitarianism regime without evidence base.
it's interesting, and the way they do it, it's always about health. You know, it's about, we care about your health, we're trying to keep everybody safe. And it preys on the good nature of people. No one wants anybody to be hurt. Nobody wants to put themselves out there and put another human being at risk. And that's how they're playing this. But it's not just altruism anymore. There's teeth behind this. I mean, you're going to get fined. You're going to get jailed. I mean, in some of the states here, they've actually started to implement some really nefarious, rules to keep you in line. I mean, in New York now, you have to tell them, give them your address of where you're going to stay. And if you don't, you're going to get a $2,000 fine. So it seems like it's gone through some sort of process where it was just fear-based. Now we've gone through a lot of it, and it's not what they said. The death rate is not what it said. We're on the other side, for the most part, looking back. And now it's become more totalitarian, like you described. There's consequences for not towing the line and getting in line and shutting your mouth. Here, we're seeing a lot of the First Amendment for us is major, but you can't seem to speak about anything. You cannot have an opinion. What's it like where you are?
Yeah, certainly people are heavily painted or painted as being conspiracy theorists and say Christian things. And the last article I did, I co-authored, is now, it's been officially refuted by a WHO, World Health Organization affiliated group. And if somebody tries to post that article on Facebook, the article I co-authored, and it's got a labeled as being misinformation, and they have another article refuting, so-called refuting our article. I'm going to be writing about that. So they just they have a lot of, they're spending a lot of time and money and human resources to paint things as if it's not the official narrative, then it's misinformation and it's damaging, and we're going to kill people if we question the narrative. So they've managed to fool a lot of people by using various techniques to capture lots of different portions of the population, the better educated, the less educated, people who consider themselves well-informed because they read the New York Times. They also believe that questioning the narrative is misinformation. There are plenty of people, I'm sure you've run into a lot of people, I do, who think that if they read the New York Times, they know what's going on. It's quite funny. So, they've fooled a lot of people. But they've been working up this, to be fair. It's not like they just accomplished all this in a few months. And there's been a lot of moves to controlling the narrative in the press for decades. I mean, it started out, the mainstream media, at least, is corporate controlled. It always has been.
Mm-hmm.
But then they've been censoring more and more, I would say, over the last at least 10 years. Anything to do with vaccines, if you question anything about vaccines, then you're detriment to society. There's very, very little that gets through in the mainstream media, at least, about problems with vaccines. So that paves the way for this COVID campaign, which includes, so many countries declaring that the only way out of this is a vaccine, and they're rushing to get this to market. And now, we're not supposed to say that there are any problems with any vaccine. There aren't any safety issues with any vaccine. So how can you question the COVID vaccine, the so-called COVID vaccine? And in Quebec, there was a legislation that the neighboring province, legislation came out in May saying they can take you away and force vaccinate you if you refuse.
Wow.
So they're busy, mandating vaccines. That's already, I think, there's more and more pushback, but there's a lot of strength in the WHO directors and public health officials and boards of health are now trained SEALs. So, and there's a lot of money to be made in all of this. The contract tracing is tens of billions of dollars. Vaccines are tens of billions of dollars. All the companies that are making the ventilators and the masks and all the other personal protective equipment and the amount of power now, quote-unquote, enjoyed by the politicians is tremendous. States of emergency, that is unprecedentedly widespread power.
I mean, we're in a position now where kind of in a lull, in a way, before everything really locks down and gets implemented. I mean, it's kind of a theoretical question, but I'll ask it. What can we do as citizens of the world to have our power back? I mean, it's being taken from us, and we're allowing it because we're sitting back and it's, I can't stick my head off because someone's going to, you know, lop it off. They're going to be mean to me. I'm going to get fired. All these things that are not logical. Are we in a position now that we need to make our voices heard in order to stop this?
Very much. Late, indeed. So by whatever means necessary in terms of, you know, many of us are writing articles and many people are sending articles around and also talking to their elected officials and their protests. There have been protests going on since at least April. Mm-hmm. And there's some civil disobedience, and there's also lawsuits. In Ontario, there was just a lawsuit launched against these measures. There's another lawsuit launched. So I think somebody was telling me at least 100 million people across North America know this is very problematic. So great strength in numbers. So people shouldn't be afraid to speak up. There's much, much more to be lost by not speaking up than there is by speaking up.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but most people can have empathy. And the people who've been on the front line of, I would say, honestly, the victims of this have been the seniors. Has there been any move? Has there been any kind of voice, somebody who can speak out for the seniors? Because if people understand what happened in that part of our population, I think they would understand that if it happens to them, it can happen to me. Is there something there that's being done to get the word out about what happened to them?
I think there's been a lot of information, but I think a lot of information that I think is misdirection. The mainstream media is certainly talking about the high death toll, and there's been talk of how that the healthcare providers were to blame, the people working in institutions, rather, were to blame because some of them were working in more than one institution. And also, as you mentioned, there were people being transferred from hospitals to long-term care homes. But I'm not sure that tells the whole story, and I think it hides some of the real, the nefarious, deliberate agenda, I believe, to reduce the population of seniors under the cover of COVID. Because there's been long moves for quite a while to reduce the population, particularly the seniors, because they're expensive. They don't pay much to the tax base. And one of the reasons they're expensive is because of pensions, both to the private sector and to the government. So there's huge, you know, the private sector is breaking their boots, but the cost it'll cost them for the pensions. It's unsustainable. They can't afford them. And particularly now with the downturn in the economy. So, and the, you know, with the government, the federal government, state, provincial government. So this is a win-win situation for the powerful to reduce those costs. And actually, I'm talking to the Office of the Ombudsman of my jurisdiction, Ontario, next week, because somebody sent them my article on long-term care home deaths and said, you guys should look into this. So they're following up and interviewing me over the phone, but I would bet a lot of money they're not going to be looking into the factors that I outline in the article, which point to possibly deliberately putting these things in place to reduce the population. So I really don't think they're going to take any serious look at the real causes for it.
Well, let's take our second break and again think about what you just said. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution with Dr. Elena George and my guest, Ms. Rosemary Frey. Before the break, you actually made a comment that I think a lot of us, again, in the back of our minds, were thinking this, but no one's really talking about the economics, at least from the government's perspective of liabilities and, for us, Social Security and the cost of healthcare, etc. It's very mercenary and cynical, but it crossed my mind what you just said. I have to admit. And as in my opinion, as the seniors go, so does everything else. Where do they stop? You know, are you going to have people with disabilities? Are you going to have young children who are born with various ailments that they end up in this catchment as well? Because the good of the many outweigh the needs of the few. I mean, this is not a system, at least it's becoming not a system about health anymore. It's about control. And they're putting all of us on a grid. If you're a physician, you can't speak your mind. You might get called in front of the board You might get your license taken away. You might get fired from your job. So there's a lot of duress going on from the healthcare side. And the Hippocratic Oath is becoming, it's becoming harder if you stay within the system to practice medicine using the Hippocratic Oath. But again, I think you made a really good point. You have to get out there. You have to be powerful, your voice, writing, you know, editorials, contacting your congressperson or your legislator, whomever, and let them know that you're out here. It's not a vacuum that they just get to do whatever they want, right?
Yes. I mean, as more and more people are waking up, there's more and more holes in the reasons that officials give for their the lockdowns or increasing lockdowns or even when they're lifting them. The numbers that they cite of the COVID cases don't match with what they're doing. So there's ample opportunity for people to scratch their heads and talk to each other via, you know, whether it's directly in person or social media or on the phone. There's plenty of people waking up and talking, and that's people power. And there's lots of good information. It can be hard to find good information, granted, even in alternative media, but find out who you trust and people you trust. And I think this is also a big lesson to people learning to think for themselves. Mm-hmm. I've had to the last couple of years, and it's startling because all of a sudden you go, you don't know who you can trust. And boy, it isn't easy if you could just assume you can trust the government. But it's certainly better for our own even spiritual development to say, I have to think for myself. I can discover real truth by myself. It's very powerful. But it's empowering, and it leads to much, much more wisdom, I think, than just going along with the flow. And it becomes more comfortable to go along with the flow, but it can lead us to exactly where we are now, where so many people are buying this information.
Well, it takes courage to think for yourself. And it takes courage to have personal responsibility. And I personally, if I'm going to make a mistake, I want to be the one to make it, not somebody telling me I should do something that I know is wrong or is going to have a bad outcome. But because I'm so frightened, I just go along with it. That's just not my nature to do that. And your article, I think, is, again, another timely article, The 7-Step Path from Pandemic to Totalitarianism. And I don't, you know, we're living in times that are, it's interesting. It's opposite of what people say. So if liberals are becoming totalitarians, people are getting killed for speaking their mind in the United States. It's really tragic, quite frankly. And it seems to be all under the cover of this pandemic, right? I mean, your article is, you're saying that we're at step 5, but for those listeners, before they get to read it, I'd like to give them a preview of what you wrote. In your opinion, is the COVID pandemic the first step towards this move, towards the 7th step? Or was this already just happening and we're just now becoming more aware because we're in the midst of it?
Well, that's interesting. I'm sure there are many, many measures being taken over the previous decades to funnel us into this state of surveillance, et cetera. But in my 7th step article, I posit there are 7 steps. The first is when the virus starts to spread around the world, and the WHO declares a pandemic, and international and local agencies say that we've got to focus on the contagiousness of this and look at all the rising number of cases, saying the virus is very dangerous. And then, you know, within very short time, within days, governments at all levels declare states of emergency. There's lockdowns, and the global economy starts to crash. And then also, then next, there are going to be daily press briefings, and they use these to flood the zone of there's only one narrative, and that we're just, the news cycle is saturated with these daily news conferences. There's very little space in that public conversation to get traction for people questioning this. And then at the same time, there's central banks and the government hand out massive amounts of cash, largely to benefit the big banks. And then next, and then they comment, and they have these high, very expensive programs they put in to compensate the people who lost businesses and their employment because of the crash that was just caused by governments in response to the pandemic, so-called pandemic. And then next, they try to rapidly ramp up testing for the virus, and a lot of personal protective equipment is produced. And then vast amounts of human resources focused on tracking and tracing people. actually exposed to the virus, the so-called virus, too, is very low. And I pointed out in my first article for Off Guardian in April that this is exactly what Bill Gates and his ilk. Bill Gates is very influential. Most people have heard of him as the founder of Microsoft, and he's very influential in public health. He's very influential in the WHO. He said in this interview that I wrote about in April, that they want people, the number of people exposed to the virus low, because they don't want people to become immune. Mm-hmm. Because then, if you're not immune, they can start selling you antivirals and vaccines. Anyway, then in step four, when the numbers of cases and deaths start to plateau in each area, local officials either claim that it's too early to tell whether the virus has finished passing through the population, so they keep things in the status quo. And meanwhile, they start to ramp up their, they continue to ramp up their virus testing and antibody testing capacity. And then this extra testing leads to, again, another peak, so-called peak. And then they start to bring in, emphasize more, you know, looking for those antibodies, and maybe we can think about, you know, some sort of layered response where the people who have antibodies can get released into employment, etc. And then shortly after that, there's large-scale human testing of many different types of antivirals and vaccines, thanks to a concerted push from the WHO, the World Health Organization, Bill Gates, pharma companies, biotech companies, governments, and universities. And then then step seven, summer ends, and soon the virus starts another cycle around the globe. Just influenza and other viruses have every year for millennia. And officials again fan the flames by posting potential for millions of deaths among people not yet protected from the virus. Then they wrap, you know, and the cycle continues. And it sounds like what you're saying, the officials are saying the second wave that I was describing in 7-7 has already arrived in places in the States.
Yeah, it has.
You know that?
I mean, well, they're saying it, and they're saying all you hear now is the number of cases. Oh, this state has had the most number of cases in a day, but the people aren't sick. They're not going to the hospital. There's shorter hospital stays. It's not the same as it was at the beginning. So even our mayor said that she tested positive for COVID, but she thought she had allergies. So this is not the same, you know, morbidity and the same presentation, but they just negate that fact. It's just the number now. So they're using the number to go backwards. Now we're going back to phase one in Atlanta and California and Louisiana. They're closing stores and restaurants and bars, et cetera, again. I don't know how people can survive economically if they have to go back, you know, in the cover of darkness and not be able to work based on numbers that don't mean the same thing. They're meaningless without the morbidity and the mortality rate. They don't tell you that. They just tell you the number of cases. And what you just talked about, what you just described, it's interesting because you just put it in a nutshell. It's all about the money, right? So if you're able to constantly gin up this cycle, as soon as you get off the merry-go-round, you're back on another one with a different virus so they can give you something else and make you pay for it. This is an issue. We need to really be aware of what's going on. It's toxic. I don't know other way to put it. On that note, let's take our last break. You're Living the Solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. And before the break, I mean, that's the steps of the move towards totalitarianism was people need to go and read that article. And they can get it at off-guardian.org. And it's an excellent article, well-researched, and it will open your eyes because you have to stop doing the same thing expecting a different result. Because at this point, you'll be in your house, not working, getting a sustainable income, and hoping for the best. That's what it seems to me. And it's not a good look. Why does Bill Gates have this much power? He's not a doctor.
People say, well, he's not a doctor, but you know what? He's very, very smart. So with that in itself, doesn't say he's not, can't do anything, but he's extremely strategic. It's a multi-generational project. There was an excellent four-part series put out a month or so ago by James Corbett of the Corbett Report talking about who is Bill Gates, where did he come from? And it talks about his father was also had a similar agenda to some extent of eugenics, which we see with what's happening with COVID, including killing off old people, and including the involvement of Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, who wrote the triaging guidelines for the pandemic, was the first author, rather, of a paper that came out in mid-March in the New England Journal of Medicine about triaging people during the pandemic. That is, you know, who should get care and who shouldn't when, quote-unquote, resources are limited, because there's so much need for hospital space. So Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel was the first author. He is a card-carrying member of the eugenic faction out there, and was one of the first people involved in the Hastings Institute, which put out guidelines just a week, triaging guidelines just a week before the New England Journal paper came out, and also this excellent. So, and Gates is involved in all this, and the four-part series that Corbett put out talks about who is he, his father, and how he's very strategically built, burnished his image by, at least one other big so-called philanthropist has in the past, and made himself look like he's just there to do good for the public, when in fact he's got quite another agenda in mind, and that is making a lot of money from vaccines, antivirals, as well also reducing world population.
It's interesting that Ezekiel Emanuel is also the architect of the Affordable Care Act, which is the formerly known as Obamacare. And if you read his complete live system, it kind of reads what you just said, that the healthcare resources should be used for certain age groups, because the others have lived a useful life and they're done. They're no longer going to contribute. So between the ages of 15 and I think it was 49, maybe in your 50s, but I think it ended pretty early, then you shouldn't be given the first rights to healthcare because, oh well. And that mentality is not appropriate. That's not about Hippocratic Oath. That's not about health, and that's not about helping people. And people need to realize that. There's no way, honestly, that you can give someone a vaccine that's been tested for a few weeks. It takes years sometimes to approve these things. How do they know what the long-term effects are? You don't. And it's experimenting on people, if you want to be honest about it.
And as you said, it's also a good argument to maybe you can't make a vaccine for various reasons. My last article was about a Bulgarian pathologist whistleblower who said there's nobody who has died of COVID in Europe, that there's no monoclonal antibodies to it, presumably because, this question of whether the virus exists and therefore whether there are any antibodies for it at all. And you can't make monoclonal antibodies without their original antibodies being found. Mm-hmm. And also, so the whole point being that it's all sort of just one falsehood after the other, and it's all about just all the money that answers a lot of questions.
I think you're absolutely right. Another little piece of this puzzle is the testing itself, right? There's questions about whether these tests are valid, like the PCR, which is the test that amplifies a piece of genome of virus, and it amplifies it in order for it to get enough so it can be read, with the mindset that if you have COVID or you have a piece of, actually, this is the problem, right? Is it the COVID virus or is it COVID-19 that they're measuring? Because everybody's had a cold. And if you're amplifying a tiny piece of DNA, will it test more people positive that actually never had it? And there's a lot of questions about whether the testing is valid and whether it's accurate.
There's a lot of questions about, there's huge very high rates of false positives, even though they never mention false positives.
Uh-huh.
They have about the antibody testing, but they never mention false positives when it comes to the polymerase chain reaction or PCR testing. That's a clue. And it's basically a coin toss whether you'll test positive or not, and yet they make it seem like, oh yes, it's very accurate, and there's no false positives, they mention false positives at all, and there's so many crazy things about it.
It is, and of course the average person is just going to take what they're hearing on the media, and the media is corporate media. I mean, just think about this for a second, folks. when you're watching your news, what's the commercials in the breaks? They're always drug commercials, some sort of pharmaceutical commercial. They're never going to be able to tell you what, have a question mark, put people on with an alternate view. That's never going to happen because you have to follow the money. And, you know, you mentioned something about the mindset of the people who are running these vaccine trials, etc. They all have something to gain. They all stand to gain because there's some sort of monetary involvement behind the scenes. I personally would just like to see everybody just be honest. Tell me what your fiduciary, you know, benefit is. Do you have a patent on it? Do you work for the company? Where do you stand to gain? It allows all of us to actually be informed consumers instead of just being told, shut up and move along. We need to know the truth. I don't think that's a lot to ask, and let people make up their own mind. What do you think about that?
Absolutely, and we should be asking why the media aren't asking public officials, and not just Trump, but members of government at all levels, what's your stock or portfolio or your financial holdings? What, do you have any financial interest in this, or do you have family members who are involved in that? For some reason, government officials aren't required to disclose their conflicts of interest, or if they do, they just say, oh, there's nothing to see here, there's no conflicts of interest. Whereas a little dig beneath the surface shows they're rife with conflicts of interest. And medicine has long had that problem. Since, oh gosh, the mid-70s, medical research used to be fully funded by the government. That really slowed down starting in the 70s, and corporations have filled that vacuum, and huge conflicts of interest arise, and they're traced true to the powerful, and of course then the powerful don't have rules that they don't have to disclose.
It's like a double standard and hypocrisy on steroids. But if the government, in my opinion, if the government's going to underwrite the national health, you know, CDC, etc., then whatever discovery they make, they should not be able to profit personally from. They work for the government. They're being paid by the government, right? So it should be property of the American people, the Canadian people, not the scientist who works for them. Do you think that would be one way to try to stop this mercenary? It'll never stop because they stand to gain by the next disaster coming along medically.
Yeah, we just need more transparency, more accountability, more honesty, and we need people like Fauci to disclose that he's profiting from some of these antivirals and vaccines that are being produced. And we certainly have to cross those, try to open our ears to people who have different points of view. That's so difficult now. I've changed so much just by saying, wait, by reading books and opinions from people whose opinions we're supposed to think are totally stupid. We're all supposed to think that the press here is just full of everything Trump, for example, says and does is absolutely ridiculous and evil. Mm-hmm. But so it says, look at Trump. Don't look at all the people in your politicians and public health officials in your own backyard who are very problematic. And people, it just dumb down the conversation. You're supposed to shout at people across opinion lines rather than saying, let's sit down and talk, and I want to learn from you.
Right.
That's been shut down, and who benefits?
The status quo benefits.
Not us.
No, it's the status quo. And we're the resource that they're going to use to make their money and to have their power. And as long as we veer from one frightening experience to the next and hoping that someone will take care of us, that's exactly what they want. They don't want someone who's going to question. I want you to tell me why I need to do something. And you need to cite your source. And you need to prove that it's a benefit to me and that it doesn't hurt me in some way. They're not about taking care of us. If they were, we wouldn't be in this position, would we?
But I also find it very difficult to find people who are, they're invested in this debate and looking to things, but they're really not willing to do their own fact-checking. They rely on people like you or me, and that's an abdication of people's personal responsibility. Don't let somebody else do the fact-checking for you. Know that you're empowered. Yes, you have the capability of looking for original sources and looking at that information, deciding for yourself. That somehow, I don't know what's caused people to, I don't know if it's laziness or they're too busy taking care of their gardens or their children, or I don't know. That's a really big problem. And also people are so busy watching TV or Netflix it's not encouraged to actually spend some time just doing research, because that's boring and antisocial. But that's essential. We should all be our own fact checkers. It's tremendously empowering, as I've said, and the truth really does set you free. It takes you out of that cave and that fog into the clear light of reality, even if that reality is frightening. I'd take that any day. It's much more valuable than living in an illusion.
I couldn't have said it better. And it's freedom. And it's, you owe it to yourself, and you actually owe it to humanity to think for yourself, because if you don't, we're not going to be in the position to be able to do that down the road from where this is going. You know, the next lockdown, the next economic turndown, the next time they take your job because it's not, you know, you're putting other people at risk from a medical perspective. And it's very difficult for most people to understand medicine, right? They're more likely, and this is actually pretty ingenious if you think about it, they're more likely to say, I don't know, I can never know, so I trust you. But you're absolutely right. You have to do your own research. You have to go, don't listen to my show and just take it. Do your research. I sit here every day and do mine. And I try to get information out to my listeners so that they can do their own research. If you don't know what you know, but, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So if you can, something jogs you. Like, for example, I had no idea the CDC was a core, it has a foundation. It's a private entity. It's not really run by the government. I didn't know that. And that took me down another path of, well, if they're really out for themselves, do they really want to work for the benefit of the American people or the world at large? Or are they just trying to make a buck? So these are all things that you have to get out there and be brave. And listening to our show, reading your blogs, listening to your interviews that you do is the first step. Because you have to have the kernel of want to, don't you?
Yeah. And it is time consuming, but people spend, I don't know, half an hour a day. They can glean a lot of information if they find reliable sources like your podcast, your information, and the Corbett Report and Off Guardian, and there's others that then they can value. It's extremely valuable.
In the 30 seconds we have left, how can people reach you? How can they read your blogs and follow you on Twitter?
My Twitter is at Rosemary Frey, T-O, R-O-S-E-M-A-R-Y, Efferson Frey, R-E-I-T-O, R-O-S-E-M-A-R-Y-F-R-E-I-T-O. Other than that, they could probably reach me through you. Yes, I'm not really willing to give out my email address because it's just too public, but...
I got you. Well, I really, really loved having you on the show. I learned a lot, and, you know, you thought we might have been far apart before we met each other, but I actually don't think we were.
I think you're right. Yeah.
On that note, I want to thank you for coming on. I want to thank everybody for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.